Let's play some cards.
I wanna hold them like they do in Texas, please.
This is The Final Table, starring professional poker player Dennis Phillips and professional broadcaster Paul Harris.
You're good, kid. But as long as I'm around, you're second best. You might as well learn to live with it.
You got to know when to hold 'em, know when to fold 'em.
Now, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan KFNS and KFNS.com.
Welcome back to The Final Table. Dennis Phillips and Paul Harris coming to you from the Rio in Las Vegas for the 43rd Annual World Series of Poker. And our guest is Maria Ho, who has been on this show every year. The show has been on the air. And last year, we were kind of a good luck charm for Maria because as soon as she left our interview, she went to play in the 5K No Limit Hold'em event and ended up coming in second to Alan Barry, winning $540,000, which is the most any woman has ever won in any WSOP event. She's also busy as a spokeswoman for WinStar World Casino in Oklahoma and is spending the summer in a house here in Vegas that I think has the most poker talent of any house in town. We'll get into that in just a few minutes. Maria, welcome back to The Final Table.
Thank you. I am so happy to be like a regular. I didn't realize I was here every year on the show for that it's been on, so that's great.
Yeah, I mean, going back to the Amazing Race years.
Yeah.
So, yeah, congratulations on the success and congratulations on the finish. You and I have texted and emailed back and forth a lot, and we were so excited when that happened for you. Take us back, if you would, to that heads up with Alan Barry, who is a guy who has a reputation for kind of getting on his opponents.
Yeah, you know, that whole, you know, experience was so surreal and just obviously a milestone for me in my poker career to be that close to a bracelet, to really have that chance to win what people, a lot of people in poker, whether you're professional or not, consider to be, you know, the defining moment for your poker career was amazing. And although I would have obviously liked to win, I feel really good about the way that I played leading up to, you know, the final table and every step of the way. And I feel more confident in my game ever since because of that experience. So I'm just trying to take the good, and I'm trying not to focus on the fact that that bracelet is on Alan Barry's wrist, which, like you said, I mean, there could be a lot better people I might, and I don't mean better by poker player standards necessarily. I just mean better in the sense of Alan Barry is known to be a little bit of a talker. So, you know.
Was he getting on you at the final?
No, I will actually have to say that Alan and I have always been, you know, amicable and cordial and, you know, friendly to each other. And he was very respectful of me. I can't say that the same for the other people, but definitely his interaction with me was actually very pleasant, especially compared to Alan Barry standards.
Wow. Like, she's such a diplomat.
I love it. I love it. I got, wow. That those few sentences right there came up with about 20 questions I want to ask. I don't even know where to go. Let's start out here. All right. You're easily one of the most successful women in poker, period. You're like 10th, 12th something in career earnings already. You know you're going to keep climbing up that one. Tell us a little bit about what is it like to be one of the, unfortunately, 5% that's playing No Limit right now? Because 95% of the people out here are going to probably be male. Do people pick on you? Do they not pick on you? Do you take advantage of it? Is it a disadvantage? Give us some insight.
Yeah, honestly, you know, I feel like that whole perception of, you know, how people play against me and that dynamic, it's always kind of shifting, and a lot of it is very player-dependent and individual-dependent. I find that for the most part, if people don't know who I am or don't know that I've had some success in poker, they tend to, you know, veer towards the side of, you know, picking on me or wanting to play a lot of pots with me or trying to bluff me or loving the opportunity to show when they bluff me, because, you know, sometimes I think, you know, everybody's really competitive when they play poker because you have to be, but there is that adrenaline. I think it comes out a little bit more when it's like a male versus female situation, and so I get, you know, a fair amount of that. But people who know me and have known that, you know, I do okay in poker and I know what I'm doing, I feel like they give me respect, and I feel like there is, you know, a definite shift, especially in the last year or two, of people kind of, you know, not only just respecting my play, but also, you know, at the table, there's just a lot more of, like, the acceptance or, like, the friendliness towards, you know, having a female at the table, and there isn't so much of a feeling that they're trying to intimidate me or they're trying to, you know, make me feel like I don't belong there.
Wow. You have to love it when somebody thinks they can pick on you at a table. I've seen you play. That you have to love that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm not, and that's exactly right, Dennis. I'm not complaining, because the truth is I've capitalized on those kinds of people all the time, and people who try to pick on me and think that I can't make a big call against them, and, you know, they're always looking to bluff me. I welcome that, because that's how I get a lot of my chips sometimes, you know?
Wow. I don't know if you remember this, but 3 years ago, you and I were playing at sit-and-go tables right next to each other here at the Rio, and we both ended up winning our table, or I think chopping it at the end. Mm-hmm. And I kept looking over and seeing your chip stack going up, and I just knew that it was a table full of guys who were playing against this, in their mind, cute girl. Oh, we're going to play against the cute girl here. And the cute girl was eating them up. But they didn't know who Maria Ho was at the time. Now people know you. You've become much more famous because of your success. Has that changed the way they play against you, both male and female?
Yeah, I do notice, you know, I have to be very careful now with, you know, what I can or can't get away with. You know, I think that there are people who, because they know who I am, they will kind of try to stay away from me, and that's also not good, because I kind of want and welcome the action.
Yeah.
But I also realize that my ability to bluff them is not it's not as successful as it used to be as well, because now that they know that I'm capable of doing things like that, whereas before they might not have thought that that was in my repertoire, you know, they kind of know now, so I have to be very careful, and it's just, you know, a balancing act of, you know, just determining what they think of me and how they're going to play against me based on what they think, and me reacting in the appropriate way.
Well, and again, for our listeners, when you sit down at a table, especially if you sit down at a table with a group of people that you've never played with before, you instantly have to categorize them by their sex, by their age, by the way they dress, by, you know, everything that you possibly can, because you have to try to figure out how to play against them, what type of a player they're going to be. And everybody will look at an older person and have an image of how they're going to play. Everybody will look at a woman and have an image of how they play. I'm telling you, if you look at Maria, that's this cute little gal or whatever the heck, you're dead.
Yeah.
She is an extremely good player. She's proved it beforehand. And, you know, I just love the idea that she takes advantage of that.
Yeah.
And then probably just smiles and says, oh, I'm so sorry.
Now, this is not just Maria who's doing this, but the three women who she's sharing a house with this summer are very good at doing the exact same thing. When I said a house with the most talent of any house in town, Maria is living this summer with Vanessa Russo, Vanessa Selbst, and Liv Boree in what Liv calls the fun house. How did that happen?
Yeah, I mean, no, that is quite the lineup, I feel like, and I feel very happy to, you know, be in that company. Vanessa Russo just recently bought a house in Vegas, and, you know, she's a great gal, but it's so funny because she was saying how, you know, throughout the years, all she's been doing is saving up her money. And, you know, for, you know, a 20s something kind of girl, you would think she's out there spending, but no, she's had it all kind of saved up, and she decided
except for
to,
a couple of cars.
Well, yes, I mean, except for that little splurge, but, no, so she wanted to buy a house in Vegas finally and move out of her condo. And she bought an amazing, gorgeous, brand new house in Vegas and was kind enough to ask the three of us to share a house with her. And so that's how it all kind of came about. And, you know, I was saying this before to somebody, how I just love the fact that we're going to be able to motivate each other in the sense that we're so competitive and we're all kind of, you know, we all have the same goals career-wise. So, you know, we're always trying to one-up each other. And now with Vanessa Selbst starting off with a bang and making that first final table, now we all have to kind of catch her, which it's good to have that friendly competition, but we are also so supportive of each other. So it's a very, very good dynamic in the house.
And we should say that Vanessa Selbst finished fourth in the first 1500 no limit event here. Were you railing her, by the way, when she got to the final table, or were you busy playing a tournament yourself?
I was playing the pot limit hold'em yesterday, but I was going back and forth, and then when I busted, I ended up staying and railing her until she busted. So, I mean, I'm a good housemaid.
You know, we haven't had a woman win an open event bracelet.
Oh, it's just a matter of time.
Vanessa Selfs did it 4 years ago.
Right.
You'd have to put your money on the Funhouse foursome to do it this year, wouldn't you?
I would think so. If you put a prop bet together, that'd be a good one to do.
Yeah.
We've had other people on here, and they've talked about how they confine. They have a group of friends. They talk about hands, strategy. Did I not play this right, that type of thing. Is that the camaraderie you're going to have in that house, do you think? You guys are going to come home. You're going to describe a hand. You're going to talk about it over a cup of coffee or whatever the heck. I mean, that'd be awesome to have that in there, I would think.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I will say, Vanessa Selfs, and I'm sure this is something people can just deduce, but she probably loves talking about hands and strategy more than any of the rest of the girls in the house. So she definitely has initiated that conversation more than any of us have at this point. But I know that we all respect each other's play greatly, and one of the best tools that we can have as poker players at our disposal is being friends with such great poker players and being able to pick their brains. So I fully expect that we're going to have a lot of powwows this summer over hands that we've played.
And competition and prop bets,
yes.
although you're probably smart enough to not to get into any sports props with Liv.
Oh, yeah. No, I knew that way before. But Liv, the hustle's over. You are not getting a dime from me, honey.
Let's talk about something non-WSOP related, and that was the iSeries Live event that happened a couple of months ago in Dublin, Ireland. We talked to Faraz Jaka a couple of weeks after the event. And he talked about how much he liked it. I actually watched the beginning of it online, and we talked on the show about the very first hand where Phil Hellmuth raised in late position with ace-king, came back around to you in the big blind, and you also had ace-king, and you three-bet him, and it came back around to him, and he made a pretty big four-bet, and when it came back around to you, you laid down your ace-king. First hand of this iSeries Live event, which was a winner-take-all shootout. Mm-hmm. Why did you make that lay down? Walk us through the hand.
Okay, so we started with 100 big blinds in that single-table shootout. And, you know, Phil Hellmuth raised from late position. Generally speaking, he has a pretty wide range when he opens from late position. But in terms of it being the first hand, add that to the fact that I three-bet him out of the big blind in the first hand, and I don't really think he thinks my range is going to be that wide in that scenario. And then having him four-bet and me having a hand like ace-king, I just didn't see a scenario where either I'm not absolutely crushed by his range or I'm at worst, at best I'm flipping because I've put him on queens, kings, aces, and ace king is just a small fraction of that, and in my mind, and he did four bet so big where I would never just call out a position with ace king there, because it was almost, I think, like 30% of my stack to just call out a position preflop, and I'm never going to be the person to five bet shove with ace king against Phil Hellmuth's four bet. Because I don't ever expect to be crushing him in his range at that point.
He almost never has ace-queen there.
I honestly, first hand of a winner-take-all with us starting with 100 big blinds, I would venture to say he never has ace-queen.
Yeah, so. Queens, jacks maybe, I could see him doing it with. I don't see him doing it with anything less than jacks there, to be honest.
I don't even see him doing it with jacks.
Yeah, I just didn't think I was. Yeah, at best, I was flipping. I'm not going to flip for 100 big blinds firsthand in a winner-take-all format. And you know,
you're no fun.
Right? Sorry, guess I don't have enough gamble.
But was part of your strategy also the fact that the longer you stay in this tournament, the more people could bet on you, because this was the first time it was a televised event. You were all sequestered, and people could go on outside the U.S. and Canada. People in Europe could go on to the Paddy Power website, which is a gambling website, and could actually bet on prop bets involving the players who's going to go out first, who's going to win the last longer, what's going to happen in the next hand, etc. And you get a piece of that action.
Yeah.
So was it in your mind, I can't afford to go out first, literally, because it would mean money in my pocket if I stay longer?
Absolutely. That definitely was, you know, an underlying factor that influenced not just that hand, but other hands that I played. Obviously, I only let that influence it to a bit. I want to always be able to make the correct decision regardless. And I think that it's not even a question that what I did against Phil Hellmuth was the correct decision, regardless of the percentage that I would be able to capitalize on getting more of had I stayed longer. But yes, that was definitely, you know, something that was running through my mind.
Well, this was a brand new series and had never been done before. They're talking about doing it, possibly expanding the field even, making a 30 or 40 people in the field. Did you enjoy it? Did you see good things, bad things? How would you change it? What's your general feeling of this series?
My general feeling is that I think it's a great and innovative concept. It's actually surprising to think that nobody's really thought of that before, because, you know, I think what poker is lacking a little bit in terms of mainstream acceptance, recognition, or interest is the fact that you can have a rooting interest without necessarily knowing that much about poker or knowing that much about the players. Because people who sports bet on other sports, a lot of the times, it's not even necessarily because, you know, it's not their home team that they're betting on. It's not necessarily because these people aren't experts, because God knows how much the bookies are making off of them. These people who are sports betting are kind of doing it for fun. And so that when they watch the game on TV, they can kind of have a rooting interest because they put some money up. And so I think that having that kind of interest in poker is something that's going to, you know, expand the popularity of the game. So anything that does that for poker, I'm all for it. And I thought it was really well run. Of course, you know, it was the first time. So there's a few kinks here and there, but nothing that can't be fixed. And I just felt like, you know, there's only room to grow within that concept. So I was really happy to be asked to be a part of it.
Everybody made money?
No, we didn't make money on the first one. But we actually did get, we got, you know, over 80,000 unique viewers on the stream, which is actually more than any, you know, like the WPT Final Table that they stream online doesn't get that many uniques. So there was a lot of interest in people wanting to watch it. And hopefully, obviously, if US ever opened up, you know, that would definitely help us making money on it and the ability for more people to bet as well.
One last question about this. They had some really interesting prop bets going on there. Did you partake in any prop bets, really like any, or do you have your own prop bet that they need to do for the next one for this iSeries?
I actually suggested to the creators if they could have a line of over under how many times Phil Hellmuth berates somebody. but like we would have to put, you know, in like small print, like what berating, like what it needs to consist of. Like it needs to be like specific name calling, whatever, you know, because Phil Hellmuth will, you know, if you count every time Phil Hellmuth has a little bit of a, you know, uproar, then that's, you know, God only knows how high that number could go up
yeah.
to. But
Phil
Hellmuth, I suggested that.
Yeah, Phil Hellmuth will comment you and then second sentence berate you, even if he's not intending to. It's amazing sometimes.
Well,
well played for being involved in anyhow.
Let's note that here at the WSOP, it took less than 24 hours for the first Phil Hellmuth dissing of another player at the table, telling him, I don't know if the word idiot was used, but it was kind of like that.
Right.
And it was on day one of the first event he played. So I think that's a great idea for a prop bet, Maria. Let's talk about tournaments here. You have played tournaments with deep stacks, and you played events like the 1500s here, where you only start with 4,500 in chips. Talk about the different strategies and which one you like.
Well, you know, the 1500s where you know, you're starting with three times the buy-in as far as stack goes. I feel like they try to give players, you know, some play early, you know, having a 25-25 level and a 25-50 level. But, I mean, those levels are kind of insignificant in the big scheme of things, and I kind of wish that they would add, you know, some levels later to have more play for people, you know, in the later stages of tournaments where I think it matters more, obviously, because there's annies, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, my strategy for those kind of, you know, more shallow stacked structures is I find that, you know, I play fairly tight and I'm very, very selective about, you know, my opponents, because at that point there's just so many bad players in the field. There's no reason, if you are unfortunate enough in a 1500 event to end up with three or four really great players at your table, there's just no reason to try to get in their way, and there's no reason to, you know, have it become an ego fest of trying to outplay each other when you know the other person's competent, when there's five other players at the table who, you know, their chips are easy pickings. So I always make sure to do that and stay out of, you know, good players' way in the early stages if I can. And I'm also, you know, very cognizant of the fact that, you know, because our stacks are so shallow that, you know, there's not a lot of post-flop play. So it's very important to make sure that post-flop you're not making any mistakes and not costing yourself more and not missing out on value bets. And, you know, I always tell people, like, these tournaments, you know, the value is so great, but you kind of have to get chips early, and, you know, there's not that much room for you to splash around. So no reason to, you know, get crazy. It's perfectly fine to play pretty ABC in the early stages of these tournaments, I feel like.
So do you set any kind of benchmarks? Because I had one pro tell me that by the dinner break, he wants to be at least the 10 to 12,000. Otherwise, he figures he's in trouble, and he'll really get aggressive on the fifth or the sixth level if he's not there.
Yeah, I mean, you can set, you know, kind of in your mind, because you know what levels are coming up next, what's going to make you feel like, you know, you're in a good place to withstand, you know, the blinds moving up and to be able to play, have more post-flop play, etc. But I never really try to go by that, or, you know, I never look at what the chip average is, because that is so, it's not relevant given the fact of there's all these other variables of, like, you know, how your players are playing at the table and who the players are. And I just try to kind of focus on, you know, the dynamic of my individual table. And so sometimes having a 20 big blind stack at a really bad table is actually a really good thing, you know. So.
Well, Maria, we wish you the best of luck this summer. I told Dennis that if we had done our fantasy picks, which we failed to do this year, I was going to have you on my team, because I know you're going to play a lot of mixed game events, which is where there's a much better chance of getting the bracelet, right?
Yes.
Because it's a much smaller field.
Right.
And you've become better at that over the last few years by playing a lot more of those events.
Right.
So I'm not going to say you're my pick in the funhouse, because that's...
I mean, no, listen, I don't take offense to that. There's a lot of talented girls there.
Well, yeah, no offense about the funhouse. I don't think there's a bad pick.
No, that's what I'm saying. So, I don't think you could pick amongst the four of you.
Thank you. But
good luck with all of that, and it's great to see you.
Thank you. And listen, if I don't make another final table after coming on this show this summer, I will not be back.
Oh, ouch.
So if you guys want to take credit for my final table last summer, you guys better put out that, like, good
vibe
right now.
We're putting Mojo's on you right now.
All right, go get him.
Sounds good. Maria Ho joining us here at the final table. Dennis Phillips and Paul Harris at the WSOP in Las Vegas on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com. And our podcast, of course, via iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and FinalTableShow.com. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show, coming to you with our continuing coverage of the 2012 World Series of Poker from the Rio in Las Vegas. I'm Paul Harris, sitting next to Dennis Phillips, and we're joined now by Corey Zeidman, who picked up his first WSOP bracelet this summer in Event 4. He's sitting here, and we can see the gold gleaming in front of us.
Yeah, you notice I moved the sleeve back.
You can see the gleam in his eyes. You know,
yeah.
And he has a reason to be proud.
Event 4 was the $1,500 buy-in, 7-card stud, high-low tournament. Last year, Corey was sixth in that same event. He's also got 7 other WSOP caches on his resume, including 3 final tables. Recognizes one of the best stud poker players in the country. And now this puts the stamp of, you are one of the best stud players. In fact, I would say right now, this is proof that you're the best stud poker player of the week.
Well, thanks. I'll see you guys later. I think my pizza's ready.
Well, you know.
Boy, he says the country, not the world, and not one of the best stud players, like, now, but just for the week, huh?
You know,
do I get to kick everybody off the island for this week?
You know I'm just kidding you.
No.
Here's the thing. I was there for the bracelet ceremony when Corey got this thing, and I've been there for others, and a lot of poker players stand there. They don't grin. They don't have any happiness about it, or they're not showing
cool.
it outwardly.
Yeah.
They're being cool. You still have a grin on your face that goes from ear to ear.
Well, that's actually a physical condition. I didn't want to get into that.
But this was this is like a life goal for you, isn't it?
Absolutely. I admit it, okay? I'm not too proud. People always try and act cool. Yes, this, that, and the other thing. I don't play in a lot of tournaments all year. Stud is my favorite game. The only real big, you know, tournaments with stud are here. Yeah. And I look forward to this every year.
But if you looked at the final 20 people who were up there, I think they said 10 of the 20 had already won bracelets in some event.
Yeah.
You had people like Mike Sexton, who has 11 caches in stud events alone.
Wow, that's amazing.
Linda Johnson, I mean, the grinder. It just goes on and on and on, because the grinder thinks he's the best stud player.
He knows I own him. He's from South Florida with me. Actually, I won the California State Stud Championship several years back, and he finished fifth. So am I allowed to say I pee on him when it comes to this?
Well, you can, because you beat him. He was at the final table with you, and you beat him.
Yeah, we celebrated for several hours this morning together.
I heard a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, we both got bailed out, so I don't really want to talk about it.
But tell us about being at that final table, and particularly when you got down to heads up, you're up against Chris Bjorn,
nightmare.
Many people may not know this, but Chris Bjorn is second only to Phil Hellmuth in career caches.
And Phil Hellmuth will definitely let you know that.
Yes, Phil would let you know that. Yeah. He's got a couple of bracelets of his own, and from Sweden, lives in London now, one of the best poker players in the world. When you get down to heads up with him, I mean, where's the mental game for you?
Chris and I, actually, 23 people left. Chris, I know a long time. We're friends, but, you know, it's not. We're poker friends. We've had dinner together. We discussed the possibility of me and him being heads up, that it was a very real. We were that confident. He's the last person in the whole group that I wanted to play heads up.
I don't doubt that a bit.
It's the truth.
Oh,
because
yeah.
He gives away a chip. If Chris could cut his chips in half with a scissor, he'd give you half a chip at a time. You know, it's late at night. We've been playing 3 days all day, all night, which did come into play. I felt that gave me an advantage, actually. As you can tell, I have a bit of energy at times.
Mm-hmm.
Not drug-induced, not five-hour energy drink. This is all natural.
Just
want that to be clear. Willing to pee in a bucket. But Chris doesn't give a – he gives away a chip at a time. And what I had to resist was that frustration you feel. You have a big hand. Folds, folds, folds. Because now when he has a big hand and he does come in, because I'm taking a couple chips, now Chris takes 20 chips from you.
Yep.
You're like, that's not good. I just won four out of the last five hands, and I'm minus for that five hands.
There you go.
Yeah.
So I decided to turn the table on him as best I could. I started to frustrate him. I didn't give him play. Especially when I had the lead. I made him earn every chip. I was talking throughout to him. Not to be mean, but I talk when I play. Surprise, surprise. And Chris was tired. It was late. I'm like, Chris, I feel great. I purposely let him. I go, yes, I'll play all day, all night. I told him, I'm going to go play some full court basketball after this is done, Chris. I'm like, Chris, how do you feel? He goes, he's like, I can't even keep my eyes open. I was like, okay. So I kept talking, and it motivates me, and a good friend of mine helped motivate me. You know, I never realized how important that could be as far as the motivational aspect from another source. Like, I feel I know the game as good as anyone on earth. I truly do. It helps not being intimidated. You know, it doesn't matter. It could be Phil Ivey. It could be you name it. I feel I'm as good, if not better than any of the other players, in stud or stud eight or better. And a good friend, Thomas Hollywood Henderson from Dallas Cowboy days.
Yep.
He's a motivational speaker. He even gives motivational talks on substance abuse, alcohol abuse to the NFL teams. He's written books, tapes, and everything like that. We've become pretty good friends. He's in South Florida a lot, as well as Austin, Texas. And he just kept, like, motivating, pumping, saying the right thing. The guy is good at it. And I always thought, you know, on your own, who's going to tell you? You know, hearing certain things just gets you right back on keel. And he was a big help to me in this. And I had everybody following. Finally, I had to shut my phone off. You know, just you have to. But it was so nice to have so many well wishes that watching it on the streaming and following it on the websites and It was just a thrilling victory for my family.
You pretty much took away my next couple of questions.
Just tell me to shut up already.
No,
I got to ask you that.
I love that. the mental stress, we talk a lot of times about the physical and being ready and this and that, but the mental stress when you're sitting at a table hour after hour after hour, especially against somebody as rock solid as Chris, I mean, that's just phenomenal.
That's a phenomenal point. People who don't know, haven't gone through this, don't understand.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
I had to catch myself at times, and I am mentally as strong as they come. You get worn down. With what we're playing here, if you let that get the best of you, 2 minutes later, it could be devastating.
Yes.
It just drains you. Drains you. And you got to catch yourself. I'm not going to give in to it. You're not going to give in to that mental stress. You let up. All of a sudden, you play a hand you shouldn't have played. You don't think it through. You don't make those quick decisions like you did. And you've really got to stay on top of that. It's not just about playing great poker. It's about beating all the different aspects of the game. There's so many parts to this that we do.
You don't go on tilt, but you have maybe a little mini tilt if you're not careful.
Yes.
And it's just a couple of hands, and all of a sudden you go, what did I just do?
Exactly. Exactly. So, and yeah. I felt that because it was going long, I felt I'm going to make sure that I don't let that get the best of me. And I felt Chris was getting tired, that I was saying to myself, let me crack him one real hand, and it might open the floodgates a bit. As far as Chris is concerned, Chris doesn't fall apart.
No.
But I felt that I did hit him a little and, you know, gave him a two body shots, and then I felt that he was kind of letting down. I kind of saw it, you know. And it helped motivate me. Even if it wasn't the case, it was going through my mind, and I'm like, let me give him one more body shot, and I think I got him. And he did make one big call. Maybe he had to. He's priced in where I felt he had to know when I raised the river. He had to know I wouldn't raise the river there without having a monster. And that was the second-to-last hand that basically I guess he had so many chips, and he basically probably had to call, but there's no shot he was going to beat me in that spot. I'm sure looking back at it, he probably knew that. But
yeah.
Felt, what the heck, I got a call.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden you're sitting there, the guy's got like no chips, and it's like, wow. But still then, you know, it's Chris Bjorn. 60-something caches, several bracelets.
200 and some caches outside of the World Series.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
He's a great player. Class act, gentleman,
yes,
tribute
very
to
much
play.
So.
Yeah.
It's guys like that. I mean, I know you guys know. I mean, you guys are credit to poker. Dennis, great representative. I don't play poker all year round, but in Florida now there's so many cash games going on. I play a lot more than I used to. It's great to meet people that you're proud of the kind of people they are. You know, it's like, you know, that's a good guy. That's a good guy.
Good ambassadors for the game.
Great. It's so important. And there's been a lot of talk over the last year, you noticed on forums about presenting, poker players need to present themselves in a better light, and most people don't listen, but I'm one of the people that think, yes, you know, act accordingly.
Mm-hmm.
Act like a real human being. I think it helps us all. It does. You know, I'm not worried about the sponsorships and all that stuff like that. Those things happen, don't happen. But for your own sake.
Yeah.
You know, the people around you, you know, we see things happen at the table that we know shouldn't happen. People maybe angle shoot or do different things.
Yep.
It's war out there. I understand. But, you know, represent well, and we all should try to.
Poker players go across all sections of society. You have everything possible. When you sit down at a table, you could have anybody in the world sitting there. So, of course, you also get some of the people that, you know, you might not normally hang with, or the people that would try to do an angle shoot. Those are a minority. The problem you have with it is one of that minority, when they do something, it gets
up.
Written about. It gets blown up. And it takes, you know, 50 people like you or Chris or whatever to counter that one bad act. And I hate that, but it's just a fact of life.
That's the way the world works.
Exactly.
It's so true.
Yeah.
But that's why the players themselves have to sort of be outspoken and police their own tables, and they see somebody doing something, speak up, you know.
I agree with, and it normally doesn't happen.
No, it does.
I 100% agree with you.
No, I've had my altercations because I will open my mouth, and I really don't care. And you become the villain when you do. Even sometimes some people at the table don't realize what you're trying to do. But, but overall, you know, poker players get a bad name from the select few that certainly spoil it.
I'd rather we be known for Magic Johnson and Larry Bird than for Dennis Rodman.
Yeah.
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 There you go.
When we had you on the show a couple of years ago, Florida had just changed the rule. The old $100 buy-in was gone, and now you could play real poker down there. At the time, you were talking about how rich a poker environment it was, because any place poker is relatively new in terms of real poker, it's always a great place to play if you're a good player. There are always going to be plenty of bad people who finally are coming to the room and playing, as Cleveland is finding out now with its first casino, and et cetera. Now that it's a couple of years into that, how's the Florida poker scene for players
like
you?
Well, I just want to tell you guys I was dead wrong. The games in Florida are terrible. None of you guys should come down.
If you say that, you can't keep smiling. As you say.
Stay home. These guys, the way they picked up on these games so fast. What I give a lot of these players in Florida to, I give them credit for wanting to learn new mixed games. They're willing to try at high levels. You know, we've had some incredible mixed games where we're playing high limit, and guys who've never played, for instance, will put stud eight or better into the mix. They'll give it a shot.
Mm-hmm.
We all get seven cards.
Yep. Yeah.
Even had one guy say it was the greatest thing on earth. Towards the end of the hand, nice guy. We're playing. It was at least 150, 300. Stud eight or better was in the mix. And he goes to me, you know what I love? First time he played stud eight or better, he goes to me, you know what I love about this game, Corey? I'm like, what? And God forgive me for agreeing with him. Because, okay, I'm not the devil. He said, in this game, you don't know which way you're going to the end of the hand.
Oh, my gosh.
So, and I'm not exaggerating. That was a basic quote. So yeah. I'm like,
your new best friend.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Come on, is that wrong?
No.
I mean, some people don't know. And the truth is, you sometimes may end up going for the high instead of the low. Yeah, needless to say, he's not playing in the game any longer. But he was a young guy, so he's got time to
learn. Well, that brings me to the next question I wanted to ask you, because stud is a game that guys over 40, maybe that's the cutoff age, 45, I don't know where it is a game that we all played when we first started out. You played draw poker and you played stud poker.
Absolutely.
Now you play no limit hold'em, and maybe your second game is pot limit Omaha. Not a lot of guys are learning the basics of stud poker. So when you play in a tournament here at the WSOP, like the one where you just got that gorgeous gold bracelet, look at the smile again. How are the younger players?
Most of them aren't that great, just to be honest. It's great that, like the World Series, I mean, there's mixed games, there's high-limit mixed games around the country in some places, some venues, and obviously these tournaments. So a lot of these young kids feel they do have to get some experience playing them, and you do get some that play well, that pick up on it. But, you know, these games, they take years to really get to a certain level, no matter who you are. Mm-hmm. You know, as you get better and better at what we play, you realize you're always learning.
Right.
I still feel like I'm still learning these games. I've been playing them forever. So they try it. I mean, we had some huge games down at the Hard Rock in Florida recently when the WPT event was down there. And we had tremendous no-limit players. Guys that are legends have made tremendous amounts of money jumping into our stud 8 or better game for big action because it was the biggest game around.
What are you playing, 75, 150, 300, 600?
It was getting up big. It went as high as 6 and 1,200.
Wow.
And we're
not
playing
a starter
with people.
Game.
No. Of course,
that's
we played
a finish game.
Of course, we were using Monopoly money, and we gave everything back. No,
yeah.
It was some sick games. And there's brilliant poker players in the game who were trying this out, and they just want the action. It was like, for those of you at home that don't see it, I'm pinching myself. No. But, so it's great that it's in the mix.
Yeah.
It's great for me, certainly, that it's in the mix. And I love limit poker. I do. I know the world loves to watch No Limit. It's an intricate game. You really, there's so much to do. And this field was tough, though. There was plenty of weak spots, but this field that I beat was really, really tough. And being the chip leader 2 years in a row, I don't know how often that's happened. So I did feel satisfaction about going into the event as chip leader 2 years in a row, the final table. And it did cross my mind, chip leader 2 years in a row, and if I do lousy again, that'll be the biggest 2-year bust out, lame out, too.
Yeah. Well, I hate to correct you, but sixth place is not bad. That's not a
when
bust
you chip
down.
Leader, though.
I know.
You're being nice,
still,
Dennis. You're being
sixth
nice.
Sixth is still very, very good.
It's good if you were maybe down to your last chip.
Yeah.
But I had tremendous determination this year. I truly did, and I'm learning from it. You know, it's always better to be positive anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you
say
to yourself, does that? He's got to make a little bit of a difference. How much of a difference do you think that really makes? And we all know that's got to be a positive. I've never been more determined. I'm a very competitive person. I've never been more determined than I was through this final table. Seriously. And I'm going to try and maintain that attitude as best I can.
You know, they have something new at the series this year, which is the sports book is allowing you to bet on the players to make it the last day.
Oh, my gosh.
I did it.
I was going to ask you, with all that confidence, did you get some money down on yourself?
I did it. I bet
reaching into
two separate tickets.
He's got pulling out the tickets here right now.
Yeah. Oh, no, this is the Texas Rangers. No, okay. No, not really. I bet this $100. That was 6-1. I mean, how cool is it to bet on yourself?
Were you 6-1 as the chip leader?
No, I was... That was put up with 23 people to go. I was the chip leader when we got to the final table.
Okay.
That
okay.
was the price when we were down to 23 the final day.
So they put the people who make the final day all go up on the board.
The final day,
and
correct.
So before you went to play that day, you thought, hey, 6-1, I feel pretty good.
Well, it wasn't even that. It was the fact that you get to go bet on yourself at a sports bar.
Yeah.
I mean,
how
cool is that?
I mean, right? I mean, I was...
You know, that means you can't be in the Hall of Fame. That killed Pete Rose right there.
I swear I never bet on poker. Now, that one I'm cashing, then I tried to bet $2 on me as well. They said it's a $5 minimum. So after I called over the supervisor, he said, no, you got to bet $5. No, $5 minimum, so I bet that one I'm not going to cash. You know, that I'm going to save.
Oh, okay, yeah. Gotcha. Cool.
And that one... Hey, guys, give me that ticket back.
Did you talk to anybody awesome. Else? Were they taking action on themselves, the other people at the final
table?
Oh,
yeah, there were people betting, for sure. I actually didn't, and I understand it. But one of the things that also motivated me was the odds boards, because I was in third chip position with 23 people to go.
Mm-hmm.
They had me in fourth in the betting.
Uh-huh.
I was 6-1.
Uh-huh.
They had Chris. He's earned it at 4-1. The guy, and Chris was in fourth chip position. They had him in second position with the odds. Okay. I'm like, okay, they're going to get cute. They're going to handicap the players now. Okay,
ooh.
That's fine. So I'm like, okay, there you go. There's a slap in the face.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, I don't care who I'm playing against. Chris knows. Chris, I'm sure, as much respect as I have for Chris, person, player, neither one of us feels that we're going to outplay each other. We have that respect. We've played for years. And but they got cute. They set the line, so that's fine. And it helped. I said, okay, I want to stick this up there, Coca-Cola.
You know, I love the idea of this, because once you cash the $100,
yeah.
it's almost like you're free-rolling on the bet with yourself.
Oh, yeah. I mean, let's face it. The prize pool, winning it, is worth $200,000, the extra $600 from being 6-1.
Yeah.
So I was kind of stupid, we're basically saying, for betting $100 instead of $5 just.
Yeah.
What's the point? But it was cool. It's just $100 to win on yourself. You know?
I started to say, well, maybe that covered last night, but I forgot you were with the Moroccan. Never mind. Yeah, that didn't cover last night.
No, it didn't come close last night. It covered the first round. Four bottles of Grey Goose at a club in Vegas.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
Okay, and not mentioning extracurriculars, the Mizrakis like to have a good time.
Uh-huh.
Great group of guys. They are. They're such a good group of guys. As we talk about credits to poker, genuine, good people.
Yep.
And I love those guys. They're outstanding. And because I picked up the tab last night, I think they love me too, finally.
Well, at least for 24 hours.
Yes, at least until tonight's dinner.
They would probably agree with me. You're the best stud player of the week.
Oh, definitely. Of the day. Those guys are rough. Those guys are brutal.
Well, listen, Corey, we are really, really happy for you. We had a great time with you on the show a couple years ago. And
you know, it's coincidental. How weird is this? Right before coming to the World Series, just looking through stuff. We had a great interview. I know we did a really good interview together.
Yes.
I had never heard it. I played it before coming.
Really?
And it was, you guys do an awesome job.
Thank you.
You do. You guys are pros. you guys put the people in the right mood. You're eloquent. You're on the money about the poker aspects. You ask things that not most people wouldn't ask. Everything about it. I was like, wow, this came out good. You guys made me look good. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. So now after today, we're 2 for 2.
Yeah, 2 for 2.
That's pretty good. 2 for 2. Congratulations.
Great, guys.
Wear that bracelet in good health.
I am. It's a pleasure seeing you guys. Be well.
Very well done.
Same to you.
And again, that was one of the toughest fields for the final 20 you could ever imagine.
Absolutely.
And you took it
down. Thank you. Yeah, it feels great. Feels
Corey
great.
Zeidman Excellent. Joining us here again on the Final Table Poker Radio Show. Dennis Phillips and Paul Harris with our continuing coverage of the 2012 World Series of Poker at the Rio in Las Vegas. On 5 Night of the Fan, KFNS and KFNS.com. And our podcasts, don't forget about those. They're available on FinalTableShow.com or via iTunes and Stitcher Radio.
I was walking through the hall here of the Rio, and I ran into a gentleman that I had played with at 3 different tables in St. Louis during the circuit event, Nick Zipkoff. And this gentleman here has a story, and we had to get him on the air. That's all there is to it. A little bit of quick background. First of all, before you played Event 5, which is the one we're going to talk about, you weren't even planning on playing that event, were you?
No, Dennis, I was not.
Okay, so what happened to make you play the event?
Well, it's a string of events that I, you can call it destiny or however you want to call it. Nice to see you, by the way. We did play a bunch of tables together at St. Louis, and we got acquainted, and now being here and sitting on your show is really awesome. So going back, I flew in from Chicago on Tuesday. And that was the 3,000 heads-up event, and I wasn't planning on playing in that. And I quickly took a taxi and went to play the 400 event in
Venetian.
The Venetian Deep Stack. And I got eliminated pretty quickly, and I had a good friend of mine that was playing on the neighboring table. And for some reason, I just said, I'll hang out with him later. I'm just going to shoot over to the Rio and see if I can make the $235 Deep Stack. I did not know that the Venetian was a re-entry event, and after speaking to my friend, after I won my bracelet, and I was speaking to my friend, he said, if you had come and said bye to me, the first words out of my mouth would have been, you know, this is a rebuy tournament, right? And I would have went back and rebought, and everything would have been different. So going back to the story, I get back to the Rio. I sign up for the $235 event, and I end up winning that. We chopped it, but I end up taking first place.
Okay, so how many people about were in that tournament to start with? 500 or 600? Ballpark.
639.
630. Well, that's pretty good ballpark. 639.
Yeah.
Okay, good enough. And first prize, even if you chopped it, was still a pretty good amount.
Yeah, first prize was over 20,000.
There you go. Cool.
And we ended up chopping it. I got a good amount of money for that. Uh-huh. And the following morning, now my schedule, last year I had a pretty terrible year here at the WSOP. I had no cashes, and I had no plan. This year I told myself I'm going to come here with a plan. So I had a string of events that I've already planned, which I was going to play. Mm-hmm. This was not one of them. My first event was going to be the 400 Venetian, which I busted mm-hmm. right away. And the second one, the following day, was going to be the $600 Venetian. And then I was going to play my first WSOP.
Now, Nick, I think, is 34 years old. He does very, very good on bankroll management, something maybe some other time we get into. This is too interesting a story. We've got to keep going with this. But, he came in, he plotted out what he was going to do, and then the very first day here, he changed it.
Well, that's the thing. You have to be flexible. You need to be able to make adjustments. And when I won the nightly the following morning, I thought to myself, well, now that, I've won my first tournament, I might be on a little bit of a heater. I'm obviously here just for the same reason everybody, every other poker player is here, to win bracelets, to play the WSOP events, and all the other events is just secondary. And I talked to a friend of mine, and I asked him, what do you think I should do? Should I stick to my plan and go back and play the Venetian? Or now my bankroll is a little bit bigger, I should just go ahead and take a shot at the 1,500 pot limit hold'em? Well, he said, pot limit hold'em is the form that, I think you're pretty good at. And a lot of the players, I think, are going to be making mistakes because they're going to be playing it just as it is a regular tournament with antes. So why don't you give it a shot? He said, I think that you should do that. And that's what I was leaning towards anyways. And I said, well, thank you very much. So I went and signed up, and lo and behold, you know, 2 days later, I'm sitting at the final table with a, you know, 5-1 chip lead playing for heads up.
But to back it up a minute now, they had the table of death when they did this.
Really?
Because they had 700 and some people to start out with, and in one table, they had half a dozen people who, between them, had 9 bracelets. Now, Nick is going, ha, boy, thank goodness I'm not on that table.
And Nick was not one of them.
No, no, not Nick no. was not
at
one of them.
At that point.
At that point. But... And first level of the tournament, your table bus, and where do you go?
Yeah, that's a funny story. I'm following Poker News, and I'm reading about this crazy table of death, table number 6. And, you know, with the likes of Phil Ivey, Shannon Shore, Kevin Stammen, and a bunch of other, you know, known huge superstars, between them having 9 bracelets, over 100 caches in the main event, over 4 WPT titles, and $38 million worth of tournament earnings.
Yeah, you know, Gavin Smith, Alan Kessler, you know, just names that you've never heard of, right?
All at the same table?
All at the same table on a random draw off a 700 player $1,500 event. And Phil Ivey, I mean, the man everybody, you know, wants to be, the, you know, the guy who's, you know, just the biggest name in poker. And I'm sitting there talking with a friend of mine on break, and I said, and this was after the second break, and I said, wow, who would be the unlucky guy who gets that seat? And I get back to my table, and everybody's gone. All I see is my chips with a card. And I look at the card, and it says, table 6, seat 6. And I said, I guess I'm that lucky guy.
So what do you wonder if somebody else got the 6 and goes, nobody looking?
Switch, switch.
Yeah, that, exactly. That could have happened, too.
Now, when you play in these events here at the WSOP and you see pros sitting at the table, you think to yourself, well, at least let me have position on them. You know, if there are 2 or 3, I hope they're to my right.
Yeah.
You can't do that when all of them are going to be on your left.
Exactly. You can't do it. I was surrounded. By that time, a couple of them had been knocked out. But when I get to that table at level 3, I believe it was, seat number 1 was Firas Jaka. Seat number 2 was a bracelet winner, which I don't know his name. I'm sorry. Seat number 3 was a very good online player. Seat number 4 was Jonathan Little. Seat number 5 was another very good online player. 6 was me. Seat number 7 was...
Is that Gavin?
Gavin Smith.
Yeah.
Phil Ivey was in number 8, and Kevin Stammen was in number 9.
Mm-hmm.
So all you got is Gavin Smith and Phil Ivey to your left.
Yeah, well, that's not a problem.
That's
yeah,
not a problem. They're not aggressive at all.
And everybody's got a mountain of chips, and I'm there with about 12 big blinds. And I told myself, you know what, this is the first time I've gotten a chance to play with most of these guys. I've played with a couple of them in some of the, you know, events, but Phil Ivey definitely. And another funny story was I was talking to that same friend on the break, and I said, you know that I've seen every single poker player live, except Phil Ivey. I just never happened to run into him. I've never seen him. I've never met him. And lo and behold, 10 minutes later, I'm sitting right next to him, and he's 2 seats to my left. So I'm one of these guys. I do not get intimidated by by really good poker players. It actually motivates me to play better. I'd like to be the last man standing. I think it boosts my confidence if that happens. And by the end of the night, I was the sole survivor of that table.
So now get this. He outlasts all these people. Gavin's gone. Phil's gone. Jonathan Little's gone. The hoping like that. You get down to the final 2 tables, so you should have some easy pickings, right?
Yeah, that's what you figure, right? In a $1,500 random event with, 700 entries on the final table, you might see one, maybe a couple recognizable names. But so we draw for final 2 tables, and on my table that we draw out of is, again, it's Daniel Negreanu. We have... John Juanda, Pellegrino, who was my heads up
Oh, the heads-up
opponent,
specialist.
And absolutely. He's a heads-up specialist. It was just another – this was just a star-studded event. I could have – seriously, if I woke up in this, I would have thought I was playing a $25,000 buy-in event because and you would never think this is a $1,500 buy-in event based on the final two tables that were left. It was
right.
Just – you know, there was no soft spots in that field.
Uh-huh. But anyhow, you get heads-up. And you've got a dominant chip. I think if I remember right, you said you took out the sixth place, the fifth place, the fourth place. You went right down the line, eliminating people. So then you got heads up. So take us there. What's going through your mind and everything as your heads up?
Well, when we started the final table, I was in fourth chip position. But having it being a pot limit hold'em tournament, we were all pretty short. I had about 10 big blinds. And everybody else had, you know, between 10 and I think the chip leader was probably what, about 20 big blinds.
Okay.
We're all relatively pretty close. And the day before making the final table, I came back with a 6 big blind stack and rolled it down to about 4 big blinds and sat and I babied that stack for about an hour and a half, doubled up, right back down to 4. So for about maybe 75% of the day, which seemed for an eternity, I nursed a 5 big blind stack, and I just never gave up. I told myself, you know what, I mean, I've already accomplished so far, you know, surviving table number 6 and being that deep. I can't give up. You know, I there was something in me that kind of felt that this was mine. You know, it was kind of, it felt right. And I made a little bit of a comeback before the end of the day, and coming back to day 2, being in 4 chip position, I started off pretty bad. For the first, I'd say maybe 2 hours, about an hour and a half, I had no playable hands. I was watching everybody else double up, and you know, a couple of people got eliminated. And Tommy Vitas, his stack just you know, blossomed, and he started kind of low. I think he was like seventh or so in chips, and I think he did take the chip lead at one point from Pellegrino, and. And you know, everybody was just involved in hands, and I was just sitting there, just looking at deuce 3 and deuce 7, and just I wasn't, you know, it wasn't my plan not to get involved. It just so happened that based on the spots and how aggressive everybody else was in the hands I was getting, I just never got a chance to play. I think I played my first hand probably like half an hour, maybe 45 minutes into the match.
Wow. Now, our listeners who heard you say you nursed a 4, 5, or 6 big blind stack for that long are probably amazed because everybody knows, quote, the rule, which
yeah.
is, hey, you get down to 10 big blinds or less, any two cards, you got to shove it in, and you got to take a chance. Why weren't you doing that? Explain it for our listeners.
I've never played a pot limit hold'em tournament in my life. This was my very first one. I do play pot limit Omaha Cash in Chicago. That's my bread and butter game. But when I came back to that second day, I really couldn't talk to any of my friends about the pot limit hold'em. None of them are experts in that game. You know, nobody plays it pretty much. They're all no limit hold'em, and it's a little different not having antes in the middle and you know, a bigger pot to steal. So when I came back, I really thought to myself. I said, it really makes no sense here to take unnecessary risks and put your money in the middle. You know, when there's nothing to steal. So I think it makes more sense in my case to just sit back and wait for a really good premium hand or wait for a very good spot. There's no need to sit there and try to bluff people off a pot because without the antes that make a huge difference, I think the you know, it's just the risk is it's too great.
Plus, I should point out, just for people who don't understand the math of pot limit hold'em,
yeah.
You obviously, because it's not no limit, you can't get it all in. You can't open shove
exactly.
in pot limit hold'em. The most you could get in is 3.5 stacks.
Exactly.
Three and a half big blinds. So if you've got 5 or 6 big blinds, yes, you have a reshove stack. If somebody else raises, now you got a big hand, you can come over the top with that. But you can't open shove and say, well, you know what, let's spin the wheel. Maybe I'm going to flip. Who knows?
Yeah.
It's a completely different strategy.
That's correct. And that's that was one of the key differences was that, again, it takes away that I'm all in. if you want to risk your stack, call me, aspect of the game. All you can do, as you said, was make it 3X.
Yeah, now
and then he can come back and put you to the test. And you don't, I don't have the stack to make, you know, to 3X it and fold. And I really don't want a 3X it and call off, because obviously if he comes over the top, he already knows I'm representing a strong hand. He probably has a strong hand as well. And, you know, depending on what your range is and what your hand is, you're either going to be coin flipping or you're going to be at a bad situation. So I just decided don't even put yourself in that situation. And I started to, and you bring up a good point, because I, instead of me, whereas in no limit hold'em, it makes more sense for you to be the first in the pot and just ship it all in. And pot limit hold'em, I believe that it makes more sense for you to wait for a premium hand, hope that you get a spot where somebody else pots it. So now you have the chance to ship it all in because the pot is already blown up.
Right.
And that's what I did. I waited for really good hands, you know, and waited for a spot where somebody already opened up and maybe had a caller behind, and then just repotted and then put that pressure on them. And it worked out. It worked out really well. I built up, from a four. I think my low point was 4.5 big blinds. And by the time we came back to day two, I was fourth in chips.
And how vitally important it is to know, in a tournament with no antes, that you have to be much more patient. You're not losing chips in 7 of the 9 hands. You can throw away 7 out of 9 hands and lose nothing. Just wait for the blinds to come around. Maybe get a steal opportunity here and there. But, you know, the same thing applies, by the way, to people who play small limit tournaments that don't have antes in them. Yeah, maybe the blinds are going up fairly quickly, 50, 100, 100, 200, 200, 400, etc. But if there are no antes coming in later in the tournament, you can get down to 6 or 5 big blinds and not have to necessarily panic.
Yeah, Paul, you're absolutely correct. And I have never been nittier in my life than in this tournament. I have literally folded ace, queen suited, king, jack suited, pocket tens. One time I folded pocket jacks because it was already potted, and I had no, I either had to repot all in, or I couldn't just flat call. And I've never folded that many hands, which in this case I think it makes a lot of sense. And I play a few tournaments, low limit tournaments, charitable events in Chicago, which follow that same structure. There's never any antes. The blinds keep on going up, but even though there are no limit hold'em tournaments, there's no antes involved. And you made a good point. And from that experience, I changed my strategy around a little bit to kind of mold and fit that pot limit hold'em structure.
Wow. I have an image of our viewers back there going, he folded jacks? He folded ace-queen suited? Yeah, in this case, yes. And I'm telling you, it worked out. Nobody can argue with it because you're the one wearing the bracelet.
Yes, and so. It did. And I had a very questionable hand at final table play. Me and Brian Pellegrino, as you guys mentioned, but I did not know him personally before we started the heads-up match, and I did some research on him before the final table began, and he came in as the chip leader. I did face him on day two for a short period of time before they redrew the tables, and I watched the way he played, and he was very aggressive. He knew what he was doing, and in my mind, I made a key note, try not to get involved with this guy, or hopefully he'll be eliminated by the time final table comes around. Well, they split our tables up. They put me on the table with Daniel and Juanda, and he actually got the easy table, in my opinion, because there was no easy table, but,
Easier
table, right. Yeah.
And 60-40.
Exactly. And when we came back on the final table, he came in as a chip leader. And so I had done some research on him. I knew he had a lot of money in earnings. I knew he was a online superstar. But my friend came and told me, you don't understand, when we were down to three-handed, it was between me and Brian and then Jonathan Aguilar. And my friend told me, you're probably, even though Jonathan Aguilar is a great, he's an exceptionally good player too, he said, you're probably better off playing him heads up because Pellegrino is just a beast heads up. And even though you have the chip lead, he's going to make it extremely hard on you. And that was the case. When we were three-handed, I had about, I'd say maybe about 70% of the chips in play, which put me in a really good position. And the two short stacks strategy dictated that they shouldn't play against me. They should, because, ICM-wise, they were better off just trying to get the other person to
you know, be knocked out by me, or they knock them out and they double up, so then this way they at least stand a chance. And they got into two pots, they got into a couple of pots, and they just exchanged chips. Pellegrino doubled up Aguilar one time, and then Aguilar doubled him up again. And just when, and I was really hoping I would face, I would face Jonathan, and he had a lot more chips than Pellegrino at one point, and they got it all in. And I don't remember the hand, but Pellegrino was on the ropes, and just when I thought he was going to get knocked out, he spiked a comeback, and he doubled up, and then a couple of hands later, I eliminated Aguilar, and now we're, me and Pellegrino are heads up. And as I was speaking about the hand with you earlier, I thought this was going to be a very early match because I had $2.4 million out of the $2.8 million in play. He only had about $400,000, which put him in a great disadvantage. He had to make a move pretty quickly. And he picked a very bad time to do that. I had 10-7. I just flatted the button, and he just checked, and the flop was queen 7-4, and he just open shipped. There was enough money in the pot at this point. He was so short that even if he potted it, it was all in. And he shipped it all in. I had second pair, decent kicker. I thought I was good, and I insta-called him. And he said, good hand, I have 6-3. He had 6-high. Though I had to fade a 5, and unfortunately the 5 did come right in the river.
There it is.
You know, right as I was at my rail, just ready to, you know, to take the bracelet, the 5 came, and he's up to 8 million in chips now. And I'm getting a little nervous. I said, I don't want this to end this way. So I doubled them up 3 times in this same fashion. You know, I grinded them down to 400. I doubled them up, I grinded them down. And we come to this hand. At one point, he's right before the last hand where he's got about 450,000 in chips, maybe a little more, maybe about 475,000. And I raised my button with ace 8 suited, and he just defended. He just flat called, and which left him with about 360,000 behind. And the flop came queen, I believe it came queen 8-7 with 8-7 of clubs. No, I'm sorry. Queen 7-9 with the, because I didn't have a pair. I had ace 8. It came queen 9-7 with 9-7 of clubs, and he just open shipped it. And I really thought that my ace high was good at this point. I thought he was making another bluff. I mean, I knew he was going to ship any non-dangerous flop, and he did. And usually I would insta call in that situation, and I kind of stopped myself. I'm like, all right, this is for a bracelet. This is a big deal. Take your time. I must have taken too much time because he called time on me. And, you know, my rail is saying, just call, call, call. And the tournament director is counting down the time, and I'm trying to think of every possible situation. I'm like, and I decided that even if I am ahead, ICM-wise, it doesn't make sense for me to make that call here, because if I double him up here and he gets close to a million in chips, it's going to be very hard on me later. If I get unlucky on one hand, or if he outplays me on one hand, we basically can be even in chips, and now that can change everything. So even though I could, and me and my friends all agreed that I probably did have the best hand, I believed it was the right strategy at that point to fold. And I always think to myself that it's always better to win the war than win the battle. And I decided this is one battle that I was willing to give up in order to win the war. And I let him have the pot. And I figured even with that pot, he'd be only about 550,000, which, you know, left me still with a huge chip advantage. And two hands later, I wake up with pocket tens on the button. I raise. He gets it all in with jack nine. He had to. The blinds just increased. He was down to about, I believe, like 7 blinds. So he just had to ship it with pretty much anything. And it held. And it was the most exciting time ever.
And then the next day, the bracelet ceremony at which the Bulgarian national anthem was played for the first time. When you listen to Nick talk, he says he's from Chicago. You might think to yourself, that does not sound like a Chicago accent. That's because he's Bulgarian. And am I correct? It's the first time your national anthem's ever been played at the WSOP?
Yes. When I won the bracelet, after the pictures and everything, they asked me at the ceremony, we know that you're an American, but you were born in Bulgaria. Which national anthem would you want to play? And I thought about it for a second, and I said it would make the most sense to me to – I mean, the American National Anthem is played every day, you know. Most of the bracelets are every year are won by Americans. And I said in order to honor my parents and my, you know, heritage and where I was born from, and having it be that the Bulgarian National Anthem has never been played, I chose that I would play the Bulgarian national anthem, and I everybody agreed that that's the, you know, that was a good decision.
Yeah.
And the following day it was played, and now I'm just getting bombarded by Bulgarian media, and it's really big out there because, you know, Bulgaria is a small country. We're only about 8 million people, which is the size of Chicago.
Yeah.
And you know they're very competitive. Back in the days, they were very big in the chess world. You know, a lot of the grandmasters came from Bulgaria. They were very big in the Olympics. So, you know, we take pride in our heritage. And my goal right now is it puts me in a really good position, being a bracelet winner and getting a little more notoriety and like being in your show. And, you know, I have probably another 4 or 5 different shows that I'm booked for. I want to bring, you know, I want to be an ambassador of poker for Bulgarians. You know, I want to make poker as big as possible there. And there's a Poker News BG and a Card Player BG, and they're really trying to get poker out there, you know. And I think this is the next step to getting it even further along. And, you know, I'm going to be an ambassador for the Bulgarian poker players.
Well, I really appreciate you stopping by here. Again, I ran into Nick at St. Louis. We just somehow or other, every time we'd move to a table, I'd look at, hi, Nick. You know, there he is.
Yeah.
You know, reacquainted ourselves here. Congratulations on your bracelet. I think right now you're in third place for Player of the Year.
I just got knocked down to fifth with the last night winners, but that's okay. You know, I'm still within reach of the
You're
player
the
of the year. And so. now that I have a little bit of a bigger bankroll, I'm planning to stay here for the full term. Again, I'm not going to get crazy and buy into every single event. And as you said, I do, you know,
just the $1 million one drop, right?
That's if anybody listening wants to sponsor me, you're welcome. Dennis has my information. Dennis.
Nick, congratulations. We appreciate you coming by the show.
All right, Paul, all right. Dennis, thank you very much. You guys are the best.
Take care.
Thank you. Nick Jevkov, a bracelet winner in Pot Limit Hold'em, event number 5 here at the World Series of Poker. With Dennis Phillips, I'm Paul Harris. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show at the Rio in Las Vegas on 5-9 of the Fan KFNS and KFNS.com. On our podcasts via finaltableshow.com, or download them and subscribe via Stitcher Radio and iTunes.